From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. In this special year-end edition, Donna Martinez and I feature some of the most intriguing topics of 2019. Legal battles continue for the man who won a Supreme Court case challenging forced unionization of government workers. You'll learn what he's working on now. Has a third grader reached third grade because he's ready for the work, or just because he's 8 years old? We'll hear from state lawmakers searching for answers to those questions. The feminist movement has had an obvious impact on women. But what about men? An expert from the Ethics and Public Policy Center offers her views of the issue. And we'll discuss ways North Carolina could do even more to add protections against civil asset forfeiture abuse. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Next year, legislative leaders are expected to begin restructuring the state's public school finance system. Their challenge is huge, but necessary, according to an analysis of the current funding system from the John Locke Foundation's education expert, Dr. Terry Stoops. In his report, co-authored with Aaron Garth Smith of the Reason Foundation, Dr. Stoops lays out a plan for revamping the broken system. He joins us now. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
You write in your report that the current way that we fund public schools in North Carolina is unfair, outdated, complex. How so?
Well, it's complex in the sense that it takes, on average, a finance leader around 2 years to understand how it works. And if you think about the fact that we have a system that takes financial experts 2 years to learn the ins and outs, you know, that should raise some alarms about the complexity of the system. But the way that it's set up in North Carolina, and it's difficult really to explain, you'd really have to see it in action to understand just how confusing it could be. Essentially, what the state does is they provide categories of funding for teachers, for school books, and for various other functions of the school. And they give have formulas that establish how much each district would receive for each of these areas. There are rules that govern whether you can take money from one area and give it to another. There are some laws that prohibit moving money from one area to another. And so we have this complex system where money getting from the state to the districts is governed by all of these formulas and governed by all of these categories that are established for the system and what the system's needs are, mainly personnel.
You write a very interesting example in the report of what actually happens on the ground based on all those formulas that you're talking about. Tell us what happens when it comes to the classroom teacher allotment and how the determination is made of how many teachers a school receives.
Sure. And this is one that's tinkered with often. So the way that this works is that the state will give a district money based on the number of students in certain grades and the ratio of students to teachers. So, for example, one teacher for every 16 or 17 students. The school district would receive money for a teacher position. That the money that they receive is based on the average pay for the teachers in the district. So that's the money that they get for that position, regardless of how much it would cost to employ that teacher. And once that allotment gets to the county, they can do various things with it. Now, this raises the question, what if it turns out that you have less than one teacher per every 16 students in, say, second grade? What happens? Well, you're not going to get the allotment for that one teacher. You have to have it break down to having a certain number of students per teacher, and that means that the remainder would not get the teacher allotment that they may need.
So our listeners can tell, even by this conversation, that this really is like a web of formulas, of rules, and it's very, very complicated and complex. You write in your report that we really should not only modernize this, but we've got to make this a lot easier for people and give them much more flexibility, because you say a principal needs to be able to control these dollars and move dollars around and be able to allocate dollars to what is actually happening in that local district and in the schools. Give us a sense of your recommendations for policymakers. As I mentioned at the top of this interview, next year, they are going to start really restructuring this.
Absolutely. And our recommendation is what's called backpack funding or student-based funding. And this is essentially looking at what the students' needs are and funding schools that way. So here's a perfect example. You have a student that's a special needs child in a low-income community. They would receive a base dollar amount that every student in the state would receive. And then there would be additional amounts added to that base amount based on the fact that they're a special needs student and they're a low-income student. And you would basically build the funding system based on the demographics and the needs of the student rather than the system like it's currently structured. This is a recommendation that would do a couple things for the state. First, I think it would give some fairness to the system that we have in place now. It would definitely be more fair. It would give some autonomy to those teachers and principals and superintendents that run school districts. It would be transparent. It would be very apparent how much a school or a district gets based on the students that they have. But I think that the best feature of this system is that in the future, it can be portable. And so if the funding is based on the student, it could also be attached to the student. And when you attach the funding to the student, the next step is to give parents the power to be able to determine where that money goes. And that's the system that I would hope that one day that North Carolina would go to. We're a long way from that. We have a lot of work to do to fix the system that's been in place for decades, the confusing, complex system that only a few people really, truly understand in the state. But I feel confident that the Republicans in the General Assembly are going to move forward in some of the initial proposals that they have had for reforming the system.
Are there any other states that are moving towards this student-centered, student-weighted approach?
Absolutely. You look at states like Hawaii and Texas, really have great systems set up for determining how that funding is allocated. But the state that I like to talk about is California, because as we know, California does very little right. I mean, California is not a state known for having good policy, but they got their student funding system right. And it wasn't easy for them to get to that point. Of course, it required an increase in funding. But they have a really great student-based funding system. And so we have examples around the nation. We have states that are using this right now. We can learn from their experiences with this system, take the best features of what's out there, and incorporate that into what's happening in North Carolina. And I think that there's an appetite, a bipartisan appetite, to do that here in our state.
I'm so glad you used the word bipartisan, because just mentioning the three states that you did here, we're talking about California, obviously a very blue state, Hawaii, a blue state, Texas, a red state. So really, this does cross political lines here to do this.
Absolutely. And it should be noted that this whole effort to look at the funding system and to consider ways to reform it was a Democratic proposal. In 2009, when the Democrats had control of the General Assembly, they commissioned a report to look at North Carolina's school funding model and to consider alternatives. They received the report in 2010, and unfortunately, that's the year when the Great Recession started, so it became difficult to implement really any kind of changes. But it was a bipartisan effort then, and fortunately, we had Republicans in the General Assembly like Craig Horne who were mindful of that report and thinking about ways to incorporate that when we have a budget that's stable like we currently have, and thinking about ways to use what that report told us should be done in North Carolina and could be done to improve our current system.
Dr. Terry Stoops with the John Locke Foundation. He's VP of Research, also the Director of Education Studies. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The U.S. Supreme Court decided last year that a government worker can't be forced to pay dues to a union if he's not a member of that union. Is that the end of the story? Well, the winning plaintiff in that case joins us now to help answer that question. Mark Janis is now a senior fellow at the Liberty Justice Center. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
When you won this case, though, you were not at the Liberty Justice Center. You were a public employee in Illinois. Tell us, when you won this case, what did that mean?
Well, it meant that approximately 5.5 million public sector workers now had a voice and a choice to decide their own fate, if you will, as to whether they wanted to be a member of the union or not. Prior to this ruling, many, many public sector union people, they were forced to pay an agency fee or a what they called a fair share fee, depending on where they were located, and which meant they had to contribute in the neighborhood of 80% towards, you know, the full share dues of a union member. However, even though they only paid 80% roughly, they didn't have a choice in a vote. You know, they couldn't decide anything, you know, in the way the unions were voting and decided their fate. And because they were mandatory in so many areas, like in the state of Illinois, they just, you know, were forced into paying this, and they just didn't have a choice or a voice in anything.
Well, your case went all the way to the Supreme Court. You won the case. So now it's over, right? Public sector workers don't have to worry about unions taking their dues if they don't want to be members, correct?
Well, yes and no. In many cases, such as the state of Illinois, for example, on the day of the decision, our governor, Governor Rauner, issued an executive order that stopped all agency or fair share fees on that day. And that became automatic. However, in other states, it wasn't quite that easy. There was some pushback. There were some, you know, different states and different attorney generals that read the opinion different ways and interpreted it different ways. And they kept charging, you know, until there was, you know, some kind of further discussion or resolution or litigation in many cases. And at the same time, the unions were doing a major pushback in the fact that they felt that, you know, their rights were being violated, which I found very interesting because they were the ones that mandated these fees and forced them upon all these workers. And, you know, the workers didn't have a choice. And now the shoe's on the other foot. And all of a sudden, they're all up in arms about it, so to speak.
Well, I was kind of asking that question with a bit of a tongue in cheek, because
right.
I know that one of the issues that that you continue to talk about is the fact that unions aren't taking this ruling lying down. They're fighting back.
Oh, they're fighting back in lots of different ways. They're providing just a plethora of misinformation to their members, you know, and or public sector workers in general, saying that, well, you know, if you don't aren't a member of our union, you know, you could lose your pension. Well, that's totally false, because the pensions are mostly administered by the employer. you know, or the government entity. And so that's not correct. They're saying that you could lose your health benefits. Well, that's false because, again, the employer provides the health benefits. They also say you could lose your wages. Well, how are you going to lose wages? Because you've got a contract that says that you're going to get paid a certain amount of money based on that contract. And the thing you have to remember is that many of these public sector unions across the country, they wanted this all-inclusive collective bargaining, whether you're a union member or not. And like in the state of Illinois, they got it legislatively passed quite a few years ago. I think it was like 1990, which mandated that the unions collectively bargain for everybody, whether you're a union member or not. And what's interesting is several years ago, Illinois Policy advocated legislation that took away that all-inclusive and said, look, if you don't want to negotiate for the non-members, you don't have to. You know, just negotiate only for your full share members. And the union opposed that legislation, which I find interesting because now that we have this ruling, you know, they're now in the process of rethinking this, but they still seem to want to continue their monopolistic ways.
That is the voice of Mark Janis, who is a senior fellow at the Liberty Justice Center. And if his name sounds familiar, that's because he was the winning plaintiff in this U.S. Supreme Court case decided last year dealing with government workers and whether they can be forced to pay union dues. After you and your colleagues won this case, were you surprised that the unions have adopted these additional tactics?
Well, not really, because during the initial filing of the case in 2015 and the fact that there were some previous cases such as Friedrichs versus California Teachers, which was originated out in California, and that case was actually a parallel and very, very similar to my case. It was resulted in a 4-4 tie because Justice Scalia passed away. And so therefore, our case then became, you know, the next one in line, if you will. And what was very, very interesting is that the unions had approximately 3 years to prepare for this, which they did by putting out mountains of propaganda, going to their state legislatures and getting laws passed, you know, to try to circumvent. And we're seeing today there's still legislation being passed in various states across the country where the unions are trying to circumvent the ruling. For example, you know, they say they no longer call it an agency fee or a fair share fee. Now they're saying that, well, yes, you can get out of the union, but you owe us a service fee. So they're just changing the name for the same thing that they had before.
Now, I have to ask, because you spent several years in court fighting this. You won, so the Supreme Court said that you were the victor in that case. You could have just said, okay, I'm done. I've won, and thank you, and I'm going to go on my merry way. Why did you decide to continue to work on this issue?
Well, mainly because I saw the large amount of pushback that the unions were putting out there, the massive amounts of misinformation, and the fact that I saw workers that even though we had this decision, were not allowed to exercise their First Amendment rights, their freedom of speech and their freedom of association. And the fact that the unions were not letting people get out, if you will, if that's what they chose to do. And I want to emphasize that, you know, this case is not about putting unions out of business. It's not about, you know, ending collective bargaining at all. It's mainly giving workers the choice to make their own decision, which they have not had in the past. And that's all this case does. You know, if you choose to be a member of the union and want to pay the fee or the dues, God bless you. Go ahead. That's your decision. But you should also have the right and the ability to choose not to, just like we do with everyday life in our day-to-day, you know, work environment or home environment.
This story is far from over. Do you think at one point we will get to the state where a government worker will have that choice everywhere across the country?
Oh, I think so. It's going to take several years. I mean, it's like a lot of other Supreme Court decisions that have come down the pike, so to speak, where people, you know, they resisted initially, but then eventually they fall in line because, quite frankly, there's a lot of litigation out there. At Liberty Justice Center, you know, who I represent and now work for, we have cases filed all over the country We have California, New Mexico, we have Hawaii, and more and more every day.
That is the voice of Mark Janis, a senior fellow at the Liberty Justice Center. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One proposal moving through the North Carolina General Assembly could shake up the way schools teach their students. Republican State Representative Craig Horn of Union County sponsors the measure.
I want to start by asking you a question. It's rhetorical, so I don't expect an answer, but I want you to think about the question. That question is, well, it's actually two questions. Have ever any of you ever had children in the third grade? And if so, why are they in the third grade? Is it because they're 8 years old, so that's where eight-year-olds go to third grade? Or is it because every subject that they're taking in third grade, they're on a third grade level? And if you think that's true, I'm going to challenge that notion and suggest to you that different kids learn different things at different rates. And that actually we need to take a different look at how kids progress through school. And look not at their age, chronological age, and look not at their grade level, whichever arbitrary grade level we may have put them in, but look at their competency. Their competency. Can they do, are they doing the work?
That's why Horn sponsored House Bill 714. What would it do?
Directs the State Board of Education to recommend how we can transition our education system in this state away from the traditional kindergarten, first, second, third, you're there because you're the right age, to a competency-based system. It's being done in some schools in this state. It's being done in some districts in this nation. I think it's time for us to look at kids themselves, the delivery of education to a child in a way that works for each and every child. All this bill asks the State Board of Education to begin that process.
Democratic State Representative Charles Graham asked for more details.
You mentioned that there are some locations where competency-based assessments are successful, and they're getting away from the traditional grade placements.
I have seen firsthand where competency-based assessments and competency-based schools for progress are successful. It's Westminster County, Colorado. A few weeks ago, we had the superintendent from that entire public school district come to talk to the Principals Association and about how they transitioned to a competency-based system. So it can work. It is working. It's a difficult change, and that's why first we need to take a look at it. Let's get the professionals here in North Carolina to take a look at it and recommend how or should we do that in our state.
A unanimous state house approved the measure. It needs support from the Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokot. There's no doubt that the feminist movement has had major impacts on the lives of women. But what about men? How has it affected them? Our next guest addressed that topic during a recent presentation for the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Mona Charon is Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's also the most recent Pope Lecture Speaker at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm guessing most people, when they think about the feminist movement and the impact that it's had, think about women.
Exactly.
Why should we also be thinking about how this has affected men?
It's a huge untold story. We have a culture and a society that is very focused on the needs of women, often in very good ways. Women have special needs at work. Women have to deal with sexual harassment. Women have challenges of various kinds with juggling home and family plus work. All right, that's fine. But what we don't tend to pay much attention to is that men in our society are falling behind in worrisome ways. We have now a situation where 60% of the undergraduate bachelor's degrees that are awarded go to women. A similar number of graduate degrees in many fields. Women are graduating from high school at higher rates than men. Women are employed at higher rates than men. Men are also falling away from their family responsibilities and from fatherhood. And what I'm worried about, and what I think our culture needs to grapple with and pay attention to, is that the decline of men as fathers and the decline of appreciating that very important role in their lives and in our society has had many, many very baleful effects. It's had bad effects on women. Girls who grow up without fathers in the home have many more problems than girls who have involved dads. But what we've found recently, what the social science tells us, and what some of those data that I was just citing suggest, is that growing up in a fatherless home is much more devastating for boys. And they are paying a much heavier price in terms of life success. So boys who grow up without dads are, we all know that they're much more likely to get involved with the criminal justice system. That's a well-known statistic. But it's also true that they're less ambitious, less likely to want to go to college, and less likely to be employed as adults than their sisters who grew up in the same home without a father. And so we need to be particularly attentive to the fact that boys need dads in order to grow up healthy and happy and, frankly, marriageable. When guys grow up without fathers, they are much less likely to be the kind of men that women want to marry. And so that's another aspect of this. It's sort of, we're all connected. You know, there's so much of a tendency to say what's good for women versus what's good for men. And what I try to say in my talk, what I said in my talk, what I say in my book, Sex Matters, is that we cannot bifurcate what's good for the sexes that way. We're too connected. If women are thriving at the expense of men, or if men are failing to thrive, it affects women and vice versa. So,
we are chatting with Mona Charon. She is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Do these harmful effects for men, do you think, result from the feminist movement, or is this just something that has happened because of such a focus on women that men have gotten left behind?
That's a very, very complicated question. I think to a degree, especially the early second wave feminists that are sort of the iconic, you know, Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and Germaine Greer and so forth, that crowd certainly contributed to this problem because they weren't content to talk about women's advancement. They also denigrated men and they denigrated marriage. They felt that marriage was a trap for women, and they were very, very keen to destroy what they called the patriarchy. And by that, they meant not just that men tend to have the corner offices, but that marriage itself was a kind of oppression of women. And I think that as a matter of intellectual history, that did affect the culture. It did serve to devalue marriage and diminish its importance for many people. Obviously, there are other things going on as well. The economy is changing to less of an industrial economy. We're now in a post-industrial or information age economy. The kinds of jobs that our economy now tends to provide tend to be service-oriented jobs, where women might have a slight advantage because women are more interpersonally sophisticated, shall we say, than men. And in general, not always, but these things are roughly true. And so those things are also contributing. But I do think that the feminist movement, insofar as it denigrated marriage and the importance of fathers in particular, played a role.
We could talk for a long time about what we do now that we know about the problem, but what do you see as sort of the first thing we need to recognize and address now that we know that this problem exists for men?
We need to focus on the fact that people in the upper third of our society, college educated and above, have figured out that marriage is important. They have a plan for their children, and they know that in order for their kids to take their places in the upper echelons of our society, that they need two parents and that they need fathers for the most part. Obviously, same-sex couples, that's not always going to be possible, but with the other two-thirds of our society, which is the vast majority of Americans, marriage has fallen so far out of favor that it is almost not the norm now. If you look at the numbers of high school dropout women, for example, who have their first baby out of wedlock, it's something like 67%. And it is no longer the norm for the for people with little or only some college education. So what do we do about that? Well, one thing, and I'll quote Charles Murray here, Murray says that the elites need to preach what they practice, because, you know, don't keep it a secret that this is one of the ways that you can have a successful life and a middle-class income or above, and that your children are likely to thrive.
So a very important message. Do you get the sense that some people are now getting this, that the evidence is so obvious that people see there's a need to act?
I'm not so sure about that, but what I do think is that it very much matters how you frame it. You cannot come to people and chastise them and say, you're a bad person because you had a baby out of wedlock or you fathered children out of wedlock. They're following the social norms that they inherited. They didn't think they were doing anything particularly wrong. It's up to us to say, hey, you might want to rethink this. Here are the facts. Here's things that you might not have heard about. I mean, I quote a young woman from a inner city high school, beautiful young gal, smart, who was told, she said, I never was told about the success sequence. That is, you know, that you should do these things in order and be sure to be married before your first child. She said, no one ever talked about that with us.
The book is titled Sex Matters. The author is Mona Charon. She is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, also the most recent Pope lecture speaker at NC State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Depriving criminals of their ill-gotten gains is clearly a desirable goal for society. The challenge, however, says our next guest, is to do that in a way that protects the rights of innocent property owners and discourages abuse by law enforcement agencies. Fact is, that can be a problem, but some states are leading the way in trying to prevent it. John Guzet is Director of Legal Studies at the John Locke Foundation, and he has just released a new report on what is technically known as asset forfeiture. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, North Carolina does have a law about this issue, and it protects us, but you say that that's not enough. Help us understand where North Carolina is on this issue.
Well, our asset forfeiture laws are actually among the very best in the country. Under North Carolina's criminal forfeiture statute, before property can be taken from somebody who's suspected of having used it or acquired it through a crime, that person has to be accused and convicted, and it has to be shown that the property really was connected with the crime in some way. That's very good. That protects the innocent, and it also discourages abuse. And another factor that discourages abuse in North Carolina is this. Law enforcement agencies cannot keep the property or the proceeds from property that they acquire through forfeiture under North Carolina law. Instead, the proceeds have to be used for public education. That's very good because it takes away the incentive to abuse the system, which has been a huge problem in many other states.
And in fact, in your report, you do point out that North Carolina actually leads in terms of protections, but that the federal government has some other laws and some other ways of doing things that allow, in some cases, law enforcement agencies to kind of skirt North Carolina law.
That's right. It's called circumvention. And the way it works is this. Under a program called equitable sharing, state and local law enforcement agencies can use federal law to process seized assets, and then they get to keep all or part of the proceeds from those forfeitures.
John, is this a problem in North Carolina?
Well, I don't think it's a problem. At least if it is, it's not a huge problem. We've looked and we haven't really found very many instances in which this process has been abused by North Carolina law enforcement agencies. There's been a few, but overall, our law enforcement agencies have maintained their integrity. And part of the reason they have, where other states have slipped into abusive police practices, is because we have these good protections under North Carolina law. What we think is important is to ensure that law enforcement agencies in North Carolina aren't tempted to use this federal anti-circumvention process as a way to get around North Carolina protections and in that way be led into bad and abusive practices.
Help us understand how the federal law works. Under what circumstances can a law enforcement agency in a state actually work with the feds?
Well, there's actually two ways state and local law enforcement agencies can take advantage of equitable sharing. The first way is if they're involved in some kind of a joint task force or a joint investigation with a federal agency. When that happens, if property is forfeited under federal law, that property gets shared, or the proceeds from selling that property actually gets shared between the feds and the state agencies according to a formula that's based on how many hours each department has worked and so on. That's one way. The other way is through a process called adoptions. Now, the adoptions program really exists only for one purpose, and that is to circumvent state laws. The way adoptions works is a state law enforcement agencies can seize property, and instead of processing under state law with all the protections provided there, they can simply have it adopted by a federal agency, perhaps by the Department of Justice or the Department of the Treasury. It'll get processed under federal law, and then they get 80% of the proceeds back. The feds weren't involved in this law enforcement operation at all. Their only job was basically to launder the proceeds through the federal system, and they keep 20% for their services.
Now, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not in law enforcement, but when I hear you describe those two ways, John, the first one, the joint investigations, frankly sounds okay to me. It sounds like you've had the federal government and a state or local law enforcement agency work together to try to get a bad guy off the street, and then the assets that were used as part of that criminal activity, they've split the proceeds. Does that seems fair?
It is. Well, let me look at it a different way. Certainly, everybody wants state and law enforcement agencies to be able to cooperate with the feds when there's a law enforcement purpose in doing so. And one of the difficulties that states have had in trying to frame anti-circumvention legislation is to do it in a way that doesn't prevent that. So everybody agrees we do want joint investigations. We do want our agencies to work with the feds. The question is, what happens if there's assets seized in the process? What we don't want is that for a joint investigation to be an opportunity for state and local law enforcement to circumvent the state laws. And that's what some of these other states have come up with ways to avoid that.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I know you're going to be writing another report here shortly about North Carolina and how we can address this issue in our state. What have we learned from other states? You've come up with three particular lessons, and one is this: to ban or severely restrict federal adoptions, because that really, you're zeroing in on that adoptions process.
I am, for a couple of reasons. The main one is that there's simply no legitimate purpose for it. Adoptions serve only one purpose, and that's to circumvent state law, so that we don't need them. If somebody suspects that a property has been used for a crime, they can seize that property and they can forfeit it under state law. There's no reason to go through federal law other than the fact that if they go through federal law, they don't have to charge or convict the property's owner. They don't have to show a nexus with the crime, and they get to keep the proceeds. That's very important. If they process it under state law in North Carolina, the proceeds go to public education. If they process it through the federal system, they get to keep those proceeds.
And no one would want a profit motive to become high on the priority list when you're talking about public safety and law enforcement.
Absolutely not. What we've seen in other states where they don't have the protections we have here is we end up with what I call predatory policing. It turns the police into predators, and it turns the public into their prey. That's the opposite of what we want from law enforcement.
That's lesson number one. You also write about this recommendation: don't divert forfeiture proceeds away from law enforcement.
Yes, the reason we don't want to do that, I mean, at first glance, you might just think, well, let's just insist that the same thing happens as happens under North Carolina law. Even if they process it through federal law, they still have to turn it over to public education. That won't work, unfortunately, because there's federal rules that say forfeiture proceeds can only be used for law enforcement purposes. Now, I'm sure that that rule was put in place thinking that it was a good idea, but what it does is it prevents the best way of protecting the public in North Carolina. So other states that have done this have found that once they've put that kind of rule in place, the feds won't cooperate with them in joint investigations. We don't want that.
And John, you also write that some states have been trying to experiment with what are known as minimum thresholds in order to figure out exactly when to get involved in this type of thing and when not to. How does that work?
That seems to be the most promising approach to continuing to cooperate with the feds in joint investigations, but avoiding the possibility of abuse. And the way these thresholds work is they say if the forfeited amount is below a certain threshold, either you can't send it to the feds or you can't keep the proceeds. Both ways have their advantages and their disadvantages, but since the vast majority of forfeitures are for small amounts, putting a threshold protects a lot of people. But because most of the actual revenue comes from the large forfeitures, it doesn't jeopardize the process.
We've been talking with John Guzet. He is the Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.